to draw a man. And the children, at the 5 years old, they draw the head and the arms and the legs poking out of the head. But you drew a perfect man. And I knew you were going to be an artist. You know, so it started that early, right? And my mother has a drawing I did of Batman and Robin, you know, from the 66 TV show with the animated sequence in the beginning with the cape flying up. I drew that when I was like 4 years old. And so I've always you know, liked drawing and wanted to draw. And since 8 years old, I knew that I wanted to do this. I wanted to draw some comic books. It's either that or work for Mad Magazine. You know, I like Mad Magazine a lot too. And so it was one of those two things. I just had to do it, you know. And so I got into high school, and I was still pursuing that. I got really, really horrible grades because all I would do is draw. And straight F's in algebra because the test was common. It was like alien language to me. So all the more I would just flip it over and draw Captain America or something. And then Mr. Parlin would go, Mr. Kapoor, this test paper is blank. And I'd go, no, turn it over. It's cool. You know, so flip it over. It's Captain America. And he'd go, F. And I'd go, no, it's good Captain America. Come on. You know, and so just as a side story, you guys, you kids now, you can't get away with murder like I could. They would send you the report cards, and I'd have, you know, Mr. Parlin's F's grace in my report card. And I would change the F's into B's. But I'd have all these horrible, nasty comments about what a terrible student I was. And my mother would read the report card and go, now look at this. Doesn't apply himself, doesn't pay attention in class, and you've got a B. If you would only apply yourself, you could get an A.
Did she ever figure it out?
No, she never figured it out. And Mom wasn't dumb. She just like pulled the wool over her eyes, and it worked. This pre-9/11, you know, they didn't have all the security in the Marvel offices in the lobby. And so I started going down with no appointments. This was just out of high school. And I'd bring my portfolio, and I thought I was so great, and I was going to revolutionize comic books and give me a job. And then, you know, I'd go down there with no appointment, and I'd go, can somebody look at my stuff? And of course, I didn't get offered a job. But they would give me critiques, and eventually I met up with one editor who recommended some books to me. And I'm making a long story short, because I'm trying to stick to the question, which I've already gone a little bit around.
We appreciate that, yes.
His Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain was one of the first books that really benefited me. And if are there artists or, you know, in the audience? Is there any? Just a couple? Three, four, five? All right, great. Well, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain is basically the American system of how we teach drawing in schools. And what it does, you know, in its essence, is teach you how to see. And the better you can see, the better you can draw. So, you know, that was one of the starting points for me. I studied anatomy, so I learned all the bones, all the muscles, where things are connected, and all that. And studied books on perspective and composition. And so I just would get all these, and cinematography, you know. The Five C's of Cinematography is a book that I studied, which is why I can tell stories, you know, visually. And that was one of the books Marvel Comics recommended. Their editors recommended to get these books. The books were Figure Drawing, For All It's Worth by Andrew Loomis, and Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain by Benny Edwards, The Five C's of Cinematography. I forgot Massouli, I think it maybe was the author. These are all the things that I devoted my time to studying. And because drawing has so many aspects to it, some of which I just mentioned, it's overwhelming. So you go, well, how do I, you know, become proficient at all these things? The way that I did it was I got a bunch of different sketch pads and all different subjects, you know, whether it was just female faces or just hands or just feet or this and that. And every day I would just take one pad and go, there's 2 hours in that, take the next pad, there's two more hours. And every day I would do that same thing, you know, just pick a different subject and devote all my study to that and do life drawing and life out of photographs, drawing out of photographs. And that's how I honed my skill. And the thing is, I'd love to still have the time to do that, but once you start working, you really don't have as much time, free time to do study. But the wonderful thing is, once you've done all that study and you are still actively drawing all the time,
revelations still come to where you come to a better understanding of the things that you've studied for all these years. So that's one of the magical things. The revelations come a little bit further and fewer apart now that I've been doing it so long, but they still come, and that's one of the beautiful magical things about being an artist. But that's how I taught myself, yeah.
So that's a lot of work, which is, of course, something that's necessary. Even if you have talent, you need to have that discipline and that dedication to your art. Absolutely. How long did you study and work and critique with Marvel, et cetera, before you landed your first larger gig?
Well, I could have done it sooner if I wasn't so bullheaded. What happened was, the first group of editors, they were really, they candy-coated things. So you'd get comments like, those curtains aren't quite, like the material really would be. And that couch is more of a prototype of a couch. Okay, that's not really helpful, okay? So, because I'm going, I go home, I go, I just have to learn to draw some curtains. And that wasn't really the message, It was how fabric works and that, counts as how, we wear different clothing and how folds form. There's actually a science to it. If you know that science and study that science, then you can fake those things because you're not working photographs all the time. And also it depends on the material, right? Silk is going to fold a lot different than heavy canvas, even though they're both materials. So you have to do a lot of this homework. So they've given me those easy lob kind of nice things, not to discourage you kind of boy. Go ahead, you're not too bad, but you got to draw a better couch. And so then I ran into this guy, Larry Hahn, who was just this brutal cutthroat editor. And he just whipped my butt. He was like, because I was from Schenectady, so he'd like to make fun of the name Schenectady. So I bet you're really great back in Schenectady. But here in New York City now, where we have the best talent, the best in the world can hear. And while your mother might tell you you're great, and your friends are all very impressed, you're not. And I'm going, oh wow, that's painful. And so then he started deconstructing me, but he was talking over my head, stuff like you're drawing symbols. That's not a nose, that's not an eye, that's not a mouth. You playing Mr. Potato Head, you're taking symbols for these things and pasting them on an oval. I don't know what he's talking about. But when you're not that good, you think you're better than you are. And so when he was talking to me like that, I didn't really understand him. And I met with him several times. And we became like adversarial now because I think I'm better than I am. And he's talking about things that I don't understand. So I think he's full of malarkey. And it ended at our last meeting with him saying, I can tell by the way you're looking at me that you think I'm full of, dookie. And I said, you're right, I do think you're full of dookie. And he says, well, you better get the fluff out of my office. And I says, I'm getting the fluff out of your office. He says, well, fluff you. And I says, oh yeah, well, fluff you. And he said, well, you better give up and drive a fluffing truck. And now the last thing he said to me, so that didn't end well, obviously. And so the last thing I was willing to do at this point, because who I was to pick up the books that he recommended because I was aggravated. And so it took like 2 years before I finally took his advice. And I went and got the books that he mentioned to him. And when I read and went through and did the exercise and drawing on the right side of the brain, all of a sudden, what he was saying to me about symbols, drawing with symbols, all of a sudden made sense. And I was like, oh, that's what he meant. So I wasted 2 years being, bullheaded before the light came on. So, what the reality is when these people like Larry Hama are giving you lessons and advice, you can be assured that they've already gone pretty high up the mountain. And so their view of the horizon is a lot broader than yours is. You're sort of down here in the base. And so you're pretty confident in the things that you can see, okay? But he can see more than I can. And so once I started climbing up the mountain that he gave me the directions, here's how you go up the mountain, all of a sudden the horizon got broader and broader and broader, and then that made sense. So how many years did it take from day one till the final moment? Probably, I don't know, I didn't keep track, but it was more than 5 years probably. And at that point, and I just want to say something on Larry Hama's credit, because there's a lot of editors in this business today who really don't like Larry Hama for his approach. And they say he could say things in a nicer way. And you know what? Maybe that's true. However, I love that
he did that to me. First off, I've got a personality to where if you tell me I can't, I will do everything to prove you wrong. And if you push me, I will push you twice as hard. And so when he did that to me, it didn't make me give up. And so if Larry Hama were to say that to anybody who wanted to do this as a living, if it made them give up, they really shouldn't be in the business, because it's a very difficult business with the constant deadlines, and then you hear, you know, people's critique of your work, and so you have to have a thick skin. So if you're willing to give up because somebody told you to, you really shouldn't be in this business. This is a business that you have to want so bad that nothing's going to break you, nothing's going to deter you, and you will come out on top. So I wasted a lot of time, and Larry Hama, I thank him for everything that he did. And so after I went through all Larry Hama's exercises and books and learned a lot, I put together new submissions, and John Romita Sr. was the art director at the time at Marvel Comics, and he actually took me under his wing, and he gave me a few fine little tweaks, and actually he told me after I became a professional, he goes, I was a little too hard on you. I could have helped you get through the door a little earlier. I feel bad about that, but I'm like, John Romita Sr., thank you for everything. And so he was the one who went start knocking on editors' doors and goes, get this guy work, get this guy work, get this guy work. So that's my start. He got me piecemeal work until they gave me my first full-time book, Quasar. And then when everybody left to form Image Comics, they put me on X-Force. And you know, the rest is history. I'm still working now.
That's very cool. And I, you know, we've talked a little bit about adversarial relationships you've had, but you, as an artist, you have to collaborate with your writer. You've collaborated with Todd McFarlane. You are collaborating and have collaborated with Scott Snyder. Can you talk a little bit about the process between the writer, the artist, et cetera, in creating a book?
Well, the only adversarial conflict I ever had with any writer has only been with Scott. here's the deal, and I'll get to why Scott and I were like oil and water in the beginning. Okay, so as a young guy, you wanted to work at Marvel Comics. Marvel Comics, the way they worked was an artist was given a plot. Okay, so it was like 4 to 6 pages, outlining the story with some evocative writing and some key moments of dialogue, and then it was all up to you on how to pace that out. And then when you turned in the story, you know, pace it out, direct it, whatever, and then hand it back to the writer, and the writer sees what you've given him, and he scripts from that. Okay, and then, so that's how I was trained. I was trained to do that, and that's my skill set. And then I worked with Todd, who came from a very similar background. Todd, I promise you guys heard of Todd before, right? So Todd and I worked even looser. We worked closer to like Stanley and Jack Kirby, in which I've heard tales where like Stanley would get up on the tabletop and go, and Spider-Man does this, and you know, to try and give, you know, Jack the idea of what he was looking for. So working with Todd was even looser than working with at Marvel, because a lot of our stuff would be just on the phone. So either I would record the conversation or jot down notes. But Todd was like this. And if you've read Spawn, all the characters I'm referring to, whatever. Greggy, I need 3 pages same as which thing you talk about this. And I don't care what they're doing, where you put them. And but give me a little room on the third page of that, because I got a lot to say. Then I need 2 pages of Terry and Wanda, maybe cyan's on the floor playing crayons or whatever. They're gonna be talking about this, and I don't care what else, but give me a little room over there, because I got a little bit to say. And that's kind of how he outlined the story for me, and which was complete freedom. Okay, so that's, then I go and work with Scott Snyder, and the first script comes off my press, and the page kind of like 50 pages. I can't even believe my printer's still printing. I'm like, what's going on? Out of paper. Out of ink. Holy crap. So I get this monster thing. It's like, issue 1. Oh my God. Right? And he's got every little nitpick and detail and every stitch of dialogue. And I read him an email and I said, look, Scott, you know, I really don't need all this. I said, just tell him, give me the important words. And he right away fires back, all the words are important. And I go, you know, that's not really true, you know. And so then he started beating his chest like King Kong, telling me all his accolades. I'm pretty good with these words. And you know, words is what I do, and I won this award and that award. And I'm reading this.
this long ass email. His email is almost as long as his script. And I'm going, oh my God, you know, I'm a guy who, you know, uses emojis. I don't have time, but here's a picture, you know? And so my wife is looking over my shoulder at all this, right? And, you know, she loves me, right? So she's protective of me. She's going, who is this guy? You know, you notice she talks a lot like every other female I try and imitate. You know, they all sound alike, as good as I can do. You know, and I'm going, you know, no, it's cool. You know, he doesn't know who I am or anything like that. And she's like, well, you better let him know. You know, and so I go, you know, he's been beating his chest like King Kong. How do I respond to this kid? So I go, I'm sure your mother is very proud. And I said, right? And Scott, God bless him, he's so sweet and so innocent. He writes me back right away. He goes, yes, I come very, very close to my family. My mother and father are very proud. And I go, wow. I just kicked him in the belly and he just didn't even feel it. He doesn't even understand. You know, you know what I mean? And so that's how that all started. And it got to a point where he was ready to quit. I didn't know this, but he told me. He goes, I was ready to walk in there and go, it's him or me, even though I knew they'd probably stick with you. And so the editor in chief, Bob Harris, was actually my editor at X-Force at Marvel. He told us not to talk to each other. He goes, just stay away from each other. You know, this is going to work out. Just put distance. And Scott and I both ignored that, and we started to talk and dialogue, and as I continued to work on his first issue, and once he saw the kind of things I was turning in, and I was more satisfied, he was more satisfied than I was. I was going, there's too many words on this page, you know, you're covering up all the art, it's no point, you know, and so there was still that contention, but we came to the understanding that we both are passionate about our craft, and that we're both passionate about Batman. And we both have a skill set, and we learned to trust each other. He learned to trust me. I'm older. I'm more. You know, I've been through more. So you just go. Once Scott realized I'm not going to drown his baby, he's going to chill out. You know, because my wife was still, you know.
You better me.
You know, and I'm going, you know, as soon as he's with her smiling, but he knows it's true. And he did. He chilled out and he smoothed out. And to this day, we're still trying to refine way we work, but he gives me a lot less in these scripts, and he's continually working to give less, and he's trying to be less wordy, and I'm teaching him how to be more balanced on the page, and how maybe you could break up chunks of words to add impact, you know. You don't have to have the whole balloon here. You can take a chunk here and put that here, and it'll have a better effect. So, you know, I've been in it a little longer, so I'm teaching him the things that I've learned, you know, throughout the years, and things like that. So we're always working together, but I'll tell you, and some of you in the audience have probably heard it a few times because it's one of the most endearing Scott Snyder stories, is now that he's less controlling, when he writes the scripts, he'll tell me his idea for a scene, and he'll end it by saying, well, whatever you want, and with the exclamation point, which was sweet enough, but then a smiley face right next to it. And so that is what makes me want to hire a toy company to make me a little Scott Snyder plush doll. That I can just, when I get the scripts and read the scripts, I can just pick up my little Scotty Dowell and squeeze it over and go, hee. So that's how it evolved with us.
You know, it's inspiring to hear that two people who came at it from very different angles have been able to work together, because that, and that it's still a process, because it's a very successful book that you're working on together, and to hear that it's still evolving means that that is just part of the process, and as creators you can move past that to the actual product. Now, working on a creator-owned book, you have more of your own direction and control. Can you talk a little bit about working on that versus collaborating with others, working on the Creech or other work you've done by yourself?
Well, working on the Creech is completely easy because I was also the writer. So, I mean, nobody's telling me what to do other than me. The other things I've done creator-owned, I mean, sort of with Robert Kirkman, he created it though with Todd McFarlane, The Haunt. And so I don't really count that, but I just got done doing Reborn with Mark Miller. And that is, he just gave me all six scripts from the start. And Mark writes in a very, very different way than I was used to, in the fact that he has it all paced out to where it'd be about four panels a page. And that's very odd pacing to have continually, because just talk shop for a second, you know, the number of panels on a page are an aspect of storytelling.
not only for if you want to build tension, or it also controls time. You know, obviously less panels, you go through them quicker than if you have multiple panels, so it also controls pacing. And so to have constantly four beats, it's kind of a strange metronome kind of way to tell a story. And so I said to him, I go, can I add beats and stuff like this? Because this is, you know, he goes, as long as, you know, my words will still line up, he goes, go for it. But after working with Scott, I'm so worn out, I just go, you know what, I'm just going to go on autopilot, keep it to four panels. Do exactly that. But creating the world and building the world is great, because no one can tell you it's wrong, right? No, that monster doesn't work that way. Yes, he does. It's never existed before. I say it looks this way. So that's one of the joys, right? You didn't build, that building doesn't look like, oh, it looks exactly like that. You know, so that's one of the cool things. No one can tell you it's right or wrong. And the other thing is, you know, and I'm lucky. I've had a great time in Marvel. I've had a great time in DC. But both of those are publicly owned companies, you know. Disney owns one. Warner Brothers owns DC. And you go, so there's certain things that, you know, you might have to, you know, oh, can't do that because, you know, we have shareholders and blah, blah, blah. Whereas Image Comics and self-published, you do whatever you want. There's no one to answer to at all. And so I'm not a lunatic. I don't want to put crazy stuff on the page anyway. But you just have that extra little freedom when you're driving down the road.
That's very cool. So I think we should open it up and see if anyone in the audience has questions. So if you just raise your hand, I'll pick someone. Yeah. That person right there.
So I've always had this strange fascination with the whole Angela, Miracle Man, Neil Gaiman, Todd McFarlane brush-up. What was your whole impact on that?
Are you referring to the lawsuit?
Well, yeah. Yes.
How are you mixed up in that?
Well, I wasn't really mixed up in it. I suppose I could have entered the fray, but, you know, and Todd actually mentioned me entering the fray at one point. You know, I didn't. But the thing about it, and obviously I'm very good friends with Todd McFarlane, and I just know Neil because I worked with him on Angela, but, you know, I really don't know him at all. And so I'm kind of biased in my opinion of whose side I'm going to take. I'm going to take Todd's side. And Neil had some valid points, but I think it's rather ridiculous that Neil was able to, you know, block up a trademark or copyright on Angels. I mean, Angels have been in lore forever and ever and ever and ever. So I thought that was a little bit odd. I think Neil probably had some valid arguments, but, you know, I got to stick with my boy. You know, that's how it goes. You know, Todd.
I think we're going to have to fight now because Neil's a friend. So I'm like, you know, we're gonna have to. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As a lawyer, I found that case extremely interesting.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, it was a little hazy. He had some.
It was. Points, there were some valid points on both sides for my legal analysis.
Right.
But
yeah.
Who else? You there with the stripes and red and black? That's you. Yep.
What's that now?
When she yelled at Stanley.
Who?
You. Okay, so I came just kind of as a blast of the past. I'm from the Schenectady area as well.
Oh.
I used to hang out with Johnny Lawrence.
Oh, Johnny Lawrence, of course.
Yeah. And we used to sometimes come and sit behind the booth with you guys.
That was it?
Yeah, it was you and Kevin Conrad.
Oh, God, you're going way, way back. Yes, hang on a minute. I'm going to come down and see you. Oh.
On you.
Oh, tattooed on you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
She said she yelled at Stanley.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll remember that, though. Yeah, he came by, I was trying to hawk some products.
And you actually yelled at Stanley?
Yeah, I knew who he was.
Wow. All right, you didn't know who Stanley was. Okay, I think we're done here. No, you did. Oh, I like that word, indoctrinate. That's right, thank you. Start the brainwashing early.
Someone else, you over there.
So, just as an artist myself, I wanted to know, when you hit a plateau, what was your approach to just overcoming it?
All right, when you say a plateau, are you meaning like a block for that day while you're trying to get the page done, or in progressing in your abilities?
Sometimes I'll have a moment where it kind of clicks and my artwork just goes into level happening, but it happens at random. But some artists have that and they know how to overcome that, right? Or they know an approach to getting there quickly.
There is really no magic. Did everybody hear his question? Okay. So there's really not a magic trick to it, man. It's just constantly doing it. Okay, now, when you're a young artist, the revelations tend to come more rapidly. You do your study, you continue to study. If you have difficulty in anything, people go, Greg, any tips for drawing, you know, feet? Yeah, study feet. You know, there's not a magic trick. I'm not going to go, yeah, you know, just, you know, put this bag on your head, roll around on grass 3 times, you know, and you can draw feet. No, you study feet. Right, and so whatever your weak spots are, you continue to study them. And after you study them a fair amount, the more you draw them, again, these lights will come on. You know, at one point, I remember, when it comes to drawing hands, going, think of it as if the fingers are as a mask, wearing a mitt, because simplifying it into like a mitt, you know, helped me to understand some of the motion. You know, so whatever your mind trick is, or whatever the revelation is, those things just come naturally, and it still happens for me now, albeit a little bit further, if you are apart, because I've been doing it so long, but those things never stop coming, and it's not something I feel you can rush, and so I would say enjoy the journey. You know, one of the things, you know, I see a lot of artists, and I'm not going to name names, but they fell into a style, they locked into the style, and I have for years, I've never seen any change in the style, and I don't think that's natural. I think that, you know, just as a human being or living creature, you live and you evolve and you change while you're alive, and when that stops, that means you're dead, right? And so it should never ever stop. And so I would say, don't get hung up on how can I do this. Just keep going, and it will happen naturally. Whatever, you know, natural process is supposed to take place in your life. As long as you're hungry and you're filled with enthusiasm and wonder, it's going to happen. So that's what I would tell you. There's no, I don't have a formula other than to just keep doing it. And one little thing for the notes of artists, you know, because everybody who draws, one of the things they get to draw pretty well first is faces. Have you ever thought, why can most people who try and draw, the best thing they can draw is a person's face? I'm going to tell you why. Because look what we're doing, we're looking at each other's face right now, right? And that's how we walk through life, and we look at everybody's face. And one of the things that people can't stand to draw, they think I'm so bad at, is feet. Mostly because we don't walk around looking at everybody's feet while we walk, okay? So one of the great things that you do as an artist is to change your focus. If you walked around all day looking at people's feet, you would get better at drawing feet because you're observing that thing. And so to change the focus, you know, some days just walk around and look at the way people's clothing is folding on their body. And you'll then start to have an understanding about how clothing unfolds and material work. And so the wonderful, cool thing about almost anything in life is the mind. If you use your mind to run through the motions, it's like actually drawing. So if I'm looking at a person, I'm imagining that I'm drawing that person's shirt. It's like I've drawn the shirt. People in sports use that. They visualize them taking a baseball swing or golf swing or whatever, and it improves their game. It improves their ability because it's like putting the body into motion because it goes to the mind first. So that's just a little tip that I've given you. No charge.
You right there, sir.
Go-to doodle? Oh, it tends to be faces. I'll just sit down. You're talking about when you're sitting down, just fooling around. It's just always faces. Yeah, I don't sit around drawing feet. You know, so there's nothing wrong with that for people really into feet.
I feel like you have something against feet here.
No, one of the few artists can really draw them. Yeah, that's because I study them. And my wife has perfect feet, by the way.
Oh, there you go. You over there?
I absolutely go
through Brian. Oh my God, I can't tell you. Since I started metal, I haven't seen the inside of a gym for 4 weeks, which is very upsetting to me. And so that makes me angry toward my job and resentful. And my wife can tell you it turns me into a nasty person, not toward her, but just a nasty person who goes around complaining, you know. You know what? The deadline is what gives you the burnout, right? If you had all the freedom and time in the world to create, it'd be musically or, you know, artistically with, you know, paints or drawing or whatever, you'd never really experience burnout. It's the have to, you know, and the clock is ticking and the have to. That's the only thing that gives you the burnout. And the sad track for, you know, what I do is the deadline doesn't move based on how I feel about it. So I could be resentful or whatever, and I have to chain myself to the table and just do it. So, and I wish there was some magical thing. I need a guru or somebody who was on a mountaintop in Tibet to teach me, because I haven't gotten there yet. I just push through, you know. But I will tell you, you know, I've got a lot going on in my life right now. I got some work burnt out, and this is coupled with, you know, deaths of people in our lives that are very close to us. And coming out to see all you guys, it relieves the stress. And so now that we're back home, I'm in the same situation, but at least I had a little bit of release. I met a lot of great people saying wonderful things, and we had a good time sharing with each other and stuff like that. So that eases the pressure. But when you're in it, man, you're just in it.
All right, you over there.
Two short questions. Who is your most favorite character to draw aesthetically, and who is your most challenging and your favorite character to draw?
Well, I mean, obviously, I've drawn a lot of Batman recently, and I do enjoy drawing him a lot. The most pain in the ass character is the one I created, the Creech. Once I, you know, was drawing him, you know, tentacles were the easiest part. All the striations that were all over, we were crossing his muscles and his costume. Those became like, man, why did I design him this way? This is a real pain, you know. And it's a lot like, you know, when Todd invented the new webbing for Spider-Man, you know, with the, you know, the wrapping around and all the twisting and all like that. After he got done doing that a few times, like, what did I do to myself? You know, I painted myself in the corner, and the editors were yelling at him, stop drawing the whip like that. You know, and he didn't listen, but he kind of probably, in some form, wishes he had, because he's like, what did I do? This sucks. Yeah, so I would say the Creech, as far as level of difficulty and pain in the assness, and Batman, because he's cool and he's sleek. Yeah.
But of course, when you're looking at it, it looks so cool. That's because of about. The detail,
that's
so,
about.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Someone else here, how about you?
Well, first off, I mean, it doesn't change my outlook about the art itself. The thing it does is it blows my mind. I mean, I remember, you know, when we were kids, wanted to be comic artists, and I used to go down to New York with the guy she mentioned, Kevin Conrad, who we went to high school together, and we both wanted to do that. And, you know, at the time, you had no idea there was any money to be had, and in a lot of cases, in most cases, there's not any money to be had in comic books. And then they told us how John Byrne, you guys heard of that guy, right? John Byrne. You guys read comics, I assume you're here. Anyway, John Byrne, they told us, oh, he makes more money than God. And at the time, that was like $200,000 a year or something like that, you know. Which, when we heard that, it didn't even compute. You know, I grew up on welfare. What is $200,000? You know, I have food stamps. You know, I don't understand $200,000. But, you know, I understand it was big. You know, and so I am blessed that I'm I can't go any higher in my field, and I make the most money that, you know, probably earn. And it's just, you know, it's difficult to describe what that's like. You know, if I sit back and stop and think about it, I go, that's really, truly amazing that you grew up on welfare now, and you like to draw, and now you're drawing, and, you know, it's made me so much money, and that's mind-blowing. But being a guy who never chased money and never, you know, when I was young, never had money, and now I have so much money that I don't even, it doesn't make any really sense to me that I have money. It's like numbers, and my wife writes the checks to the tax man, and I go, wow, that's a lot of money. I went to the tax man, you know. But it's just not a component for me, you know what I mean? I still don't focus on money.
I'm blessed. I'm no longer struggling. No food stamps or anything. No more government cheese, and I can buy mostly anything I want. And so the fact that that came to me as a result of my hard work and my passion, it's a lucky blessing. And I say lucky. People go, no, it's not lucky. You work for it. But there's a lot of people, you know, across our country who work very, very hard every day, and they don't get the rewards. So I always think that there's luck involved. Now, you know, there's a lot of great talented people. Why me? I say, why did this happen to me? So I just consider it a blessing, and it's humbling, and I'm grateful. But it's still just about drawing for me. That's, you know, it's not about how much money I can make. It's about, I want to draw this as best as I can. And I want to do it for two reasons. I want to do it for my own pride and self-respect, but also to give you guys the best I can give you. I mean, you're spending $4 or whatever you're spending on a book. I don't want you to go, wow, what a waste of trash, you know? And, you know, if I was giving you trash, you would quickly not want to look at my artwork. And I want you to look at my artwork. That's what I got into it for. So I don't think about the money, you know?
Okay, this patient person in the back there raising their hand the whole time. And this may be our last question.
You're talking about for the new 52 designs?
How often did they really expect you to guys to draw all of those detailed and to the
team? Well, I don't know. I don't know. Excuse me. I was given, when I took over Batman, Jim Lee's design, and so this is what the costume looks like. I stayed pretty close to it, but what I didn't like that Jim did, which was made it look like all shiny armor. You know, but that's sort of Jim's thing. And so I tried to keep all the same seam lines, but make it more look like dull finish, more like a Kevlar, instead of like a shiny armor. So that's the way I took some license with it. And before I left Batman, I gave him a new costume, and I've only seen like one guy draw the belt right. So, I mean, you know, obviously there's nobody cracking a whip looking over somebody's shoulder. But now that I'm drawing Batman, you'll see it being drawn correctly.
I think we can do one more. How about you right there?
Well, again, if you're an artist, you're always going to want to give it your all, at all times, do your best. As I said earlier, you know, but I don't do anything crazy, so it really doesn't affect me. But if you want to go off-the-wall crazy stuff, you'd have to stick to a company like Image that doesn't answer to shareholders and companies like Disney and Warner Brothers. Then you have total freedom to do whatever you want. But again, I'm not one of those kooky guys who wants to draw anything outlandish, so I've never really felt any restraints.
Okay, maybe one more. Who wants to go?
She's the key.
How about you right there? Last one for real.
Artists, do you actually have any say when it comes to the storyline? Like, if you're writing metal, Scott writing metal, you draw, do you have any say of what might come up or any characters that might show up later?
Scott always asks me what I'd like to draw and if there's any characters specifically that I'd like to draw. And if I do have something like that, he'd write them in. As far as anything beyond that, I change things sometimes that I think will be better if I do it this way as opposed to the way it's written. And that's fine, because I have my point and smiley face to back that up. So it's okay, whatever you want. So.
Okay, well, thank you, Greg, for coming and sharing all of this with us. Thank you, audience. You guys have a good one.